This is the takeaway for Monday, December 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Very happy to have you with us today. And Merry Christmas if you're celebrating today. We wish you and your loved ones a very happy and joyous holiday.
Bells will be ringing, the sad, sad news. Oh, what a Christmas to have the blues.
Later on this hour, one of the stars of the hit musical Hamilton brings some Christmas joy to our studios. Leslie Odom Jr. talks about his new Christmas album, his life as a performer, and he's going to sing a little for us, too.
Once again, choirs will be singing.
But we start in Puerto Rico, where Christmas has arrived just 3 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. Christmas is a big deal in Puerto Rico. Celebrations start after Thanksgiving. They tend to not stop until January. But this year, thousands of buildings on the island still don't have power, and that includes the churches. The National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference estimates that nearly 3,000 churches were damaged or destroyed when Hurricane Maria hit at the end of September. Pastor Bert Pizarro is pastor of Connected Life Church in San Juan. I spoke with him about what this Christmas will be like for people on the island at the end of a very difficult year.
Puerto Rico's always been a culture of festival. People are very happy. Nevertheless, with all the devastation after the Hurricane Maria, we're doing our best just to thank God for everything he's taken us through these last 3 months.
What about your own church, Pastor, the Connected Life Church? Is your physical plant damaged? Is your building okay?
Our building was fine because we're in the metro area, but I would say it was last week we finally got power to our building, and we actually hold evening services. So for us, that was a great challenge. Even though the people still came out, we had to run everything through generator and fans. It would get really hot. But we've been doing a lot of Christmas outreach. More than anything, we've been doing church in the street, not only in our local community, but all over Puerto Rico, and just blessing the children with great Christmas activities.
Pastor, there seems like there's two sides to this now for folks like you. There's the ability to worship, to actually have a church or have services, and then all of the other services that churches like yours take part in the community. Talk about those two things. Let's talk about the religious life first. I know it's pretty important there in Puerto Rico. Many of your colleagues in other churches, I'm sure, have had their buildings damaged and are having some difficulty.
Oh, yes. I know many of the friends and pastors that we've been helping out all over Puerto Rico. And it's been difficult, I'll tell you, in the fact that, you know, you have a membership, let's say, of 100 people, 150 people. And then from one Sunday to a next Sunday, and even after the following months, you just see that number of people dwindle. I don't know if it's this transition of families leaving to the States to look for better opportunities, or once again, that things are slightly normalizing, that maybe some people are just, you know, going back to their regular lives, and church has not been the number one thing again on their agenda. So, you know, we as pastors are talking about it, but we also know that the holidays are here. And sometimes some people just like to take vacations through the holidays.
Those are the services, Pastor, some of the religious life that you're responsible for. You also take on some responsibility, I take it, outside of the church, in the community, with charity, with community work. That's needed more than ever, but also difficult.
Yes, yes, Todd. Well, let me explain a little bit. I remember when the hurricane was coming, I was telling my wife, I said, our ministry will change, I told my wife, on Thursday. And I just kept saying that from Tuesday all the way into Wednesday night. Our ministry will change Thursday morning. And it really has. We have had over 25 teams come, 200 plus volunteers just come through our ministry. I'm working together with the Assemblies of God. I'm a U.S. missionary with the Assemblies of God. So many of the churches started contacting us and saying, how can we help? We want to send teams over there. So when my local leader here, who I report to, he said, I know you have experience in this, and I need you to just, you know, take this on, spearhead this. And from that, our ministry has gone exponential, from helping people muck out of their homes, pressure washing their homes, to feeding thousands upon thousands of people. We're talking about tons of food we've been able to give away, and water, from transporting the elderly from one location to another location, from helping to reconstruct churches and putting their roofs back on. And we can keep going down the list. And that's what we've been doing for close to 90 days.
Bert, you said that God is in control of this situation, and you sound like a man who believes that God is in control. I ask this question with the most respect, but as somebody as religious as you, how's your faith been? I mean, you're hard at work delivering help to members of your community, providing counsel to them, providing spiritual guidance. What about the cause of this storm in the first place? What about all the struggle that you and other Puerto Ricans are going through?
Sure, it's a great question. The Saturday before Maria came, I opened the Bible after prayer, and I was just led by the Holy Spirit to go to Isaiah 41:10. And it says, "Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. I am the Lord your God, and I will be your help." And it was like the letters on those pages just jumped out and became life to me. And I knew that God was going to help out our island. And I know that God is in control. I just came from a Christmas party not too long ago. And the first thing that somebody from the governor's office was saying, the governor thanks the church for being the number one responders. Not the local government, not the central government, and not even FEMA, which we're very thankful for them. But it's been the church through the power of God. Now, my faith through my long days, you know those verses that are very practical, that you find them in mugs, you find them in plaques? Those are the ones that have been feeding my soul the most. To trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. And I find myself in a place that, you know, we want to do so many plans, we want to do so many things, but at the same time, the way that we're helping Puerto Rico and thousands of people, my understanding can wait, but my obedience cannot.
Well, Bert, is your faith tested by a God who I think you probably believe had a hand in causing this disaster in the first place?
Well, I would say that, you know, when I looked over the trees the first few weeks when everything was bare, I definitely sensed that the Lord was humbling the island of Puerto Rico with its people. And of course, our faith understands why, God, you know, there's many righteous people here that have been faithful. But, you know, the Bible says in Romans 8:28 that all things work together for good for those that love the Lord. And that's where we need to be patient. And that's where we need to know that God's word will stand forever. And I'll tell you, Todd, we've been seeing the blessings of the Lord. We've been seeing the supernatural testimonies in the midst of the pain, in the midst of the suffering. We've just been seeing the hand of God helping Puerto Rico.
Pastor Bert Pizarro, hard at work in Puerto Rico and his community, helping to rebuild after the storm. Pastor, Merry Christmas to you. I know how hard you've been working and how much people in your community rely on you. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Todd. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Pastor Bert Pizarro is pastor of Connected Life Church in San Juan. Tomorrow, we're dedicating our entire show to a look at the year in natural disasters, from the devastation of hurricanes Maria and Harvey and Irma to wildfires out west. 2017 has been a catastrophic year for FEMA. We'll talk with the chief of FEMA, Brock Long, and get updates from the places hardest hit. That's tomorrow, here on The Takeaway. It's an old American problem, one that many elected officials have promised to solve. In rural areas, homeless veterans are a special challenge. There aren't very many shelters, and homeless people aren't living on the streets like they do in cities. Sarah Harris is a contributor to North Country Public Radio. In this story for the American Homefront Project, she visits a small town in upstate New York to see how veterans and their advocates cope with this reality.
Downtown Ballston Spa is full of charming old Victorian houses, but there's one that's different than its neighbors, the Vet House. 14 formerly homeless veterans live here. It has a comfy frat house vibe. There are guitars propped up in the corners, military flags and posters on the wall. The kitchen is overflowing with food.
It's cozy.
It's super cozy.
It's very cozy. All the guys get along. We all cook clean, look out for each other.
That's Dave, who moved in a couple weeks ago. He's a Navy veteran and doesn't want his last name used because of the stigma around homelessness and addiction.
I started to have a drinking problem when I was in the military, and about a year ago, got kicked out of my house.
Then he bounced around. Detox, rehab, a group home, and for a while, his brother's couch.
Did you think of yourself as homeless during that time?
Yes. The only thing I had was a vehicle that... my ex-roommate had co-signed for, so I had to get rid of that. So I wasn't homeless, but I didn't have a job, didn't have anything else going for me at the time.
Transitional housing for veterans is rare in rural areas, and most rural homeless vets have few options.
The bottom line is that a lot of them at times are either couch surfing and they don't have a permanent, you know, place to sleep at night.
Leah Rosenberger is the executive director of the Veteran and Community Housing Coalition, which runs the vet house.
A lot of times we find that the last tangible materialistic items that they have is a vehicle. So a lot of times they'll be sleeping in those. Or there are some encampments throughout the community where individuals are staying together in tents.
I go to visit some of those camps with Robert Curry, who works at the Shelters of Saratoga. They're hidden in plain sight, behind the grocery store, near the train station. You have to look closely to spot the tarps through the bare trees.
Oh, yeah, I see like a mattress, a couple of mattresses.
We hop out of the van and crunch down a well-worn path.
You can see like a frame of where they had a tent up. There's a bicycle, carts full of stuff, hats, bottles.
These types of living situations make it hard to know just how many rural homeless vets are out there. Catherine Monet is the executive director of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans.
Because it's such a challenge to count people in rural areas and services are so spread out, I don't know that the numbers even that are out there for rural veterans are accurate.
Monet says structural barriers can make it hard for low-income rural veterans. Finding affordable housing in small communities, getting to VA clinics, which can be far away, and finding a decent job. That means, for many, homelessness could be just one step away. Stephanie Maxwell works with the Veteran and Community Housing Coalition. She's an Army reservist, and she knows what it's like for the veterans that she works with. When she moved back to upstate New York a couple years ago, she had trouble finding an apartment she could afford and ended up couch surfing with her two kids.
I started to realize, like, wait, this is my life. Like, I don't have a home. I don't have a house. I get how easy it could have been for me to be on the street.
Ultimately, Maxwell got out of that cycle of couch surfing. She's found an apartment and steady work. Her advice to rural veterans who are facing homelessness: find an organization in your community. It might be a social service agency. It might be a church. Then pick up the phone, make the call, and don't be afraid to ask for help. I'm Sarah Harris.
We just heard about some of the challenges facing homeless veterans in the United States, but across the country, the problem is much bigger. There was an increase in homelessness in America in 2017 for the first time since 2010. That's according to a new report sent to Congress earlier this month from the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs. That report uses data from the Point in Time Count. It's a count of both sheltered and unsheltered homeless people on a single night in January. And that number, in January 2017, 553,742, up 1%. From 2016. Julie Watson is a reporter covering military affairs and the San Diego region for the Associated Press. She's also part of a reporting project on homelessness from the AP called Crisis on the Coast. Economies are growing on the West Coast from Seattle down to San Diego, and it's making homelessness worse.
All these cities have seen a boom in their economies because of the tech industry, but they've also seen a huge rise in their rents and a severe shortage of affordable housing.
Now, that's a phenomenon we've heard of before. We talked about San Francisco just a couple of weeks ago on this show. A metropolitan area, of course, home to the tech boom, continuing home to the tech boom, where the downtown core is much nicer, if you like, much more modern than it used to be. Those rents go up, and that means that a lot of people who live downtown can't afford it anymore.
That's not just a San Francisco problem. It's also happening all the way down in San Diego. San Diego has been rapidly changing its downtown. You see luxury condos going up. At the same time that this has happened, in the past year, there were more than 400 makeshift shelters that popped up. So tarps and tents that blanketed the sidewalks, so much so that school kids couldn't walk down in certain streets. They couldn't walk down the street.
Who are the homeless today in America, or at least on the West Coast where you've been reporting?
There, of course, is a large, chronically homeless population who are mentally ill and have problems with drug addiction. But there's also a huge population that are the working poor, basically.
You've described some of the phenomena in local economies that are driving homeless rates up. What held that off for so long? Were we doing something right?
Actually, yeah, and homeless advocates will say that they see even this latest report indicating that in 30 states, you've seen homelessness still drop between 2016 to 2017. But I think what they would say that has worked across the country is being able to get people into permanent housing. I know in San Diego, they set a goal a few years back to put 1,500 people into permanent housing. And recently, the head of the Housing Commission said, we did that. But the problem was 3,000 more people became homeless and went out on the street at the same time. So it's having to catch up, and there's going to be a lag for a while where there's just not enough units that have been built that are low-income units.
What is the city doing to address homelessness right now for people who don't have a place to go?
San Diego faced a unique situation in some ways in that it had one of the worst hepatitis A outbreaks in the past 20 years in the United States, and hepatitis A lives in feces, and so it was basically being spread among the homeless population that was living on the streets. And so San Diego faced an urgent need to do something to get people off the streets. So they first opened a campground in October, and they had about 200 people living in tents on an asphalt parking lot that had been used for city vehicles. And now they've opened 3 tents. Their hope is this will buy them time until they can start getting funneling people into permanent housing.
This is now a public health and safety issue. Unfortunately, sometimes it takes a crisis like that to really focus like a laser beam.
Julie Watson, that's Lori Zaff, a San Diego councilwoman who you talked to, talking about hepatitis A. How bad did that problem have to get in San Diego before the city responded?
The death toll was climbing from November of last year until September of this year, when you really started to see action. It got up to in October, and it's kind of remained steady at 20 deaths, but it was hundreds of people who had become sickened and scores who were hospitalized before the city took action.
Well, Julie, you're describing decrepit, in some cases horrific conditions, unsanitary conditions, certainly across the city, that they've tried to address with these industrialized tents that you describe. Let's listen to somebody that you talked to. This is Christine Wade, living in one of the camps where you've been reporting from.
It was definitely relieving. This place, it gave us showers. You know, it gave us security. It gave us safety. You know, nowhere's perfect, but it definitely took a huge boulder off of me. That's for sure.
Julie, that's Christine Wade. You know, it's one thing for us to talk about numbers or laws or actions from the city of San Diego. This is the voice of a real person whose life seems to have been transformed by what's going on in San Diego.
Yeah, so I met Christine in October, and she, at the time, was 7 months pregnant, and she had 6 children. They were all inside a Coleman tent that had been pitched on an asphalt parking lot, and she was saying that she felt so grateful to just to have that. She had come from a shelter downtown that had rats that were eating through their clothes and their bags. She could hear them at night crawling around. She and her children both described to me what it was like and how horrific it was. They had to be out of the shelter every day by 6 a.m., and this kid's school didn't open until 8, so they would just wander around for 2 hours, you know, this gaggle of kids and Christine. I think her situation really tells you what people are going through. She had been married to a man who was addicted to drugs, and that's basically why they ended up homeless. And then after she became homeless, then she found out she was pregnant as well, and then lost her job. She was in poor health and had a number of absences at her job. So she just felt like she had gotten into this pit that she couldn't climb out of.
Julie, you described what San Diego is doing. They're trying to build permanent housing. We've reported on that in other cities as well. But this trend of high rents, this trend of economic boom, at least in the short term, isn't going to change in these cities. Can they keep up with the problem that a booming economy has created?
That's a good question. And I think it's a question that no one has a definitive answer to. It's a very complex issue. It involves landlords, developers, the political will, everybody getting on the same page. And also voters. In L.A., for instance, they have approved $1.2 billion to build 10,000 units over a decade for the homeless population, which is within the city of about 34,000. I mean, there are billions being spent from Seattle down to San Diego. A total of about $8 billion since 2015 has been being spent. Whether they can keep up, I think it's what I'm told by most city officials is they're just trying to buy time to be able to play catch up because this problem had been festering for so long that it's gotten to the point where it's going to be a while before they'll be able to break even.
Julie Watson in San Diego for the AP, reporting on military affairs and regional news there. Julie Watson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we have an update on this story since Julie and I spoke. Christine Wade, who you heard from there, living in a tent with her children in San Diego earlier this fall, has recently found a permanent home. This is The Takeaway. For most of December, we've been bringing you conversations between Koa Beck and Jessica Bennett, two women in top jobs at influential news outlets, tasked with covering the treatment of women at a critical moment in this country. Koa Beck is the new editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and Jessica Bennett holds the newly created post of gender editor at the New York Times. They both started their jobs in the last few months, and they both have big goals.
One of my ambitions for Jezebel is that I really want to reframe, quote-unquote, women's issues under a spectrum of gender, and not just account for women, but I want to account for other marginalized genders as well, particularly non-binary identities. One of the things that I think is so compelling about this landscape now is that in the current dialogue of gender and rights, and particularly under a Trump administration, you don't necessarily have to identify as a woman to have your constitutionally protected rights to an abortion taken away from you in this country. But I do not see enough conversation and dialogue around that. And in my Jezebel tenure, that is a conversation I want to host and have.
And for what it's worth, you know, we were specific in the creation of my role in that it was going to be called gender because we wanted to include those things. Like, this isn't just about feminism and quote-unquote women's issues. That is a piece of it, for sure, but it's also about race and class, and it's about seeing all of the topics we cover already, whether it's sports or business, through this lens of gender. And so I think that's really the goal.
Koa and Jessica have been appearing on The Takeaway for about the last month. And if you missed any of their conversations with us, now's your chance to catch up. This is the very first of their conversations on The Takeaway about the challenge of covering gender right now and the challenge of a media environment where so many of the stories have been told by some of the same men accused of sexual harassment and assault. First, Koa Beck from Jezebel.
I think it absolutely has pulled the wall down in terms of who curates our cultural conversations. The guardians of the topics and the ways in which those conversations are presented to us, the fact that these have been curated by people who have these allegations, says a lot about their views of women and other marginalized genders, their views of what is deemed top of mind, what is the priority, what is a story.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's crazy to look at these men and to think about just how significantly they have shaped our understanding of the world, from politics to media to who gets their stories told to culture to film and television. I mean, it is truly epic in so many ways. And so I've been just thinking about that a lot. You know, what does it mean to have our cultural conversations for years and years and years shaped by men who clearly do not value women and do not respect women? And what does it mean that Harvey Weinstein has been able to, even if we weren't fans of his specifically, literally infiltrate our brains just by cultural consumption, like the number of movies? And in some of these cases, it's hard to quantify. It's like, okay, how do you think about the overall impact that Harvey Weinstein has had on, you know, our children's thinking about how they view the world? And in some cases, it's actually concrete. You know, the Amazon executive who was fired for assaulting and harassing young women on his staff, he canceled the show The Good Girls Revolt. The show The Good Girls Revolt tells the story of the women of Newsweek magazine, which is where I began my career, who sued for gender discrimination in the year 1970, essentially paving the way for female journalists. That is a direct connection to a piece of culture lost, canceled by a man who we now know to harass women.
More with Jessica Bennett and Koa Beck in a moment.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com.
We continue now with Jessica Bennett of The New York Times and Koa Beck of Jezebel talking about the significance of this Me Too moment.
I think really just game-changing for me as a queer woman who's worked in media for 8 years is that I'm now seeing sexual harassment, assault, sexual violence be the top of the news cycle for more than 4 days. We're so used to the news cycle of one allegation coming out and then a very rich, usually white man goes on paid leave for 6 months. And then Woody Allen has another movie and then everybody goes. And it's heartbreaking and very crushing every time, especially to be the reporter who has sat with these survivors and to ask them to share something like this and knowing the repercussions they're going to take and then to have it be everywhere and then have nobody care after 4 days. So in this particular climate, I do see a certain shift in terms of the conversations going beyond the predators who have often picked them. And I think it reveals a lot also, I think, to public and readers about how these stories get visibility and don't. Look at the people who are choosing them. Look at how they have violated people.
I keep sort of frantically thinking to myself, like, people are going to have fatigue. There's going to be fatigue. Mm-hmm. And one of the really remarkable things is that there is not. Like, this continues to bubble up. This feels like a tsunami. Like, I can't stop using bad weather metaphors for this. It's like tsunami, avalanche, hurricane, whatever it is. It's continuing to happen, and the stories are continuing to be told. And there seems to be no end in sight, and that is depressing on many levels. But I think it also shows that there is such hunger for these stories to come out, and maybe we are reaching some sort of tipping point.
I also, like you, share the overall fright that people will stop caring and that people will just start to glaze over, especially readers. They won't care anymore. I also want to offer them, as an EIC, more than just, here is another template of violence and abuse. One of the things that we have discussed as a staff internally is that these absolutely have to be logged. They have to be registered. But how can we push it beyond the impetus being on survivors to share these accounts, because there is a responsibility there. They're sharing it. So what are we going to do?
So last week, we launched a newsletter called The Me Too Moment. And, you know, part of my job description was to get a gender-focused newsletter off the ground. And the idea was, you know, we would strategize on that and we would come up with our visual identity and we would launch that in early 2018. And then it was like, oh, psych, we got to do this right now. Yeah. And so I found myself last week typing and retyping and retyping and retyping an intro to this newsletter, which is a temporary newsletter as long as we need it, which maybe won't in fact be temporary. But every time I wrote a new top to it, a new story would break or I would have a new idea about how we should be thinking about this. And so I do think that we're not experiencing reader fatigue. Readers are really thirsty for information about how to continue to think about this, but there is a sense of being overwhelmed. And I find myself overwhelmed. You know, how are we supposed to think about this? There are so many new cases every day. And so what this newsletter aims to do is kind of guide people through that.
I would say that I hope for you being at such a crucial role for the Times that your role as gender editor impacts other roles at the Times, that as gender editor, you see more of your colleagues and perhaps editors and teams underneath you develop a literacy on gender that they clearly need and that they need from someone like you.
Yeah, I've been joking that I will be successful when my job no longer is needed. And so essentially my job is to work myself out of a job, because I think you're exactly right. Like, this is something that should exist across sections, across desks, across platforms, and we, you know, are committed to doing a better job of that. But yeah, you know, a gender editor shouldn't have to exist. Like, a gender editor exists because media was created by and for white men largely. And so we're closing that gap, I hope.
Koa Beck is the new editor-in-chief of Jezebel and a fiction author. And Jessica Bennett is the new gender editor at The New York Times, as well as author of the 2015 book, Feminist Fight Club.
The Takeaway is supported by ACLU, which works nationwide to protect the constitutional rights of all people. ACLU.org. ACLU. We the people.
putting together my first book, I did a stretch in Washington as a newspaper correspondent. And every day I went over to the Congress, that grand old benevolent national asylum for the helpless. And I reported on the inmates there.
That was Mark Twain you're hearing there speaking to a crowd in 1967. Well, actually, it was Hal Holbrook playing his legendary role as Mark Twain in his one-man show in 1967. Mark Twain's literary legacy has transformed him into a larger-than-life American legend. Well, earlier this fall, there was a new addendum added to Mark Twain's history. It's a story that began when a Twain scholar named John Bird stumbled upon a previously undiscovered manuscript.
The thing about the manuscript that really took his breath away, there was a little scribbled note with editorial suggestions from Twain's daughter, Susie. And that was the moment when Bird got chills down his spine and realized he was reading what was probably a description of a story Twain had actually told his little girls.
Mythili Rao is a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour. She recently wrote in the pages of the New Yorker all about the purloining of Prince Oleomargarine. That's the title that was given to Twain's discovered manuscript. Twain's story was published by Penguin Random House back in September. The book lists Mark Twain as an author, but also on its cover are two collaborators, Philip and Aaron Stead. And it's the liberties that the Steads took in finishing the book, including the choice to make the main character African-American, that generated the most buzz around the posthumous publication.
The manuscript that Twain left is 16 pages long, and it kind of ends in the middle of the story. It's also, I mean, I'm calling it a manuscript, but it's really notes. These are fragments, kind of plot points, some descriptions, but there's a lot that's missing. The Steads are award-winning children's author illustrators, and they were brought on to turn these fragments into a real story. They were nervous about taking on the project because Mark Twain is such a beloved icon, and they knew they were going to have to make some choices kind of on his behalf and were worried about getting it right.
Let's listen to co-author Philip Stead talking about, in a way, collaborating with Mark Twain.
Delving too far into his catalog, it doesn't take you very long to start getting the heebie-jeebies about something that he'll have said. And he's so tricky because he can on one page seem progressive well beyond his years. And then the very next page, he'll say something that just makes you smack yourself in the forehead and say, I can't work with this guy.
But Philip Stead did work with this guy.
Yeah. So to get in the mindset of writing a Twain story, what Philip did and what he's talking about there, he read two of the three volumes of Twain's gigantic autobiography. And it gave him a sense of Twain's voice, but there were also things in there that troubled him. You know, some of his politics were really at odds with what the Steads felt was important to put in a book that's being published in 2017. I think the biggest choice that the Steads made, and maybe the boldest choice they made, was to make the protagonist of this story, Johnny, black. And that's not something that was explicitly mentioned anywhere in the manuscript.
And that's a choice that has turned out to be very controversial, especially in the context of Mark Twain's anthology and his career, his authorship of Huckleberry Finn, one of the most important novels in American history and one of the most important novels about race. Here's Aaron Stead, the illustrator, talking about her decision to make Johnny black.
In truth, the most honest answer is that it's just the way I saw him from the beginning. But also, the truth is that, you know, you have all these fairy tales and it's, in the fairy tales we know, you see a lot of little blonde girls running around, and with this one, I wanted it to be different.
Mythili, was this problematic for people? She's right that a lot of fairy tales, traditional fairy tales, have little blonde girls running around. On the other hand, one does not necessarily take liberties with one of the greatest American authors of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Stead's decision to make Johnny black came from a very honest place creatively. And, you know, the point that Aaron makes about blonde girls running around in the fairy tales we know is a real one. The Cooperative Children's Book Center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison keeps stats every year on the number of books that are published that feature non-white characters. And in 2016, the number of books that are about black children or black characters, it's still only 8% of the 3,000-some books that are published in the U.S. every year. So, you know, this is a real issue that there just aren't black faces in many children's books. And I think the Steads are right to want to change that.
Well, I mean, Mark Twain never shied away from issues of race at all. In fact, he dealt with them head on in more than one book. And one of the arguments here is that if Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, had wanted Johnny to be black, well, he would have done it. He would have made him black.
That's exactly what several Twain scholars told me, that Twain was never shy about these things. So one of the Twain scholars I spoke with did say, you know, it is plausible to think that Twain could have had a black character. The question is this character in this book a good representation of how Twain may have thought of a black character?
Right. Well, you spoke with David Bradley Jr., who's a novelist and essayist, about this very question.
The whole conjunction of Mark Twain and anything racial is politically loaded. Was he a racist? Wasn't he a racist? And it's sort of amusing because he is such a figure. That question isn't asked by most other writers, American writers. And I think the reason is because Twain actually did something about race, and most of them didn't.
That's David Bradley Jr., who is African-American, sort of making the point that Mark Twain was interested in race his whole life. He wasn't shy about it. And if he wanted to address race in a story, well, he would have.
Bradley felt strongly about that and, you know, a little skeptical, to be honest, of the publisher's motives in making a character black where there wasn't any historical record for it.
Well, Mythili, you know, we've covered in the past undiscovered books from famous authors. I have to say, at times, it's exciting when they're discovered and then the story's maybe not that great. There might be a reason they never published it. Is this one good?
This book has gotten terrific reviews. And, you know, one thing that's interesting about it is, like, it clearly grew out of a story that Twain was telling his daughters. But the book that is being published is something more complicated. Mark Twain is a character in it. Philip Stead, one of the authors, is a character in it. They have a conversation about the story. They argue about the story. There are a lot of layers there. And so I can't yet imagine reading it to my young son, but I'm curious about how actual kids will respond to it. And if it brings them closer to Mark Twain and gets them excited about Mark Twain, I think that's exactly what the folks who originally found this manuscript would be excited about.
The sort of new children's book is called The Purloining of Prince Oleo Margarine. The authors are Philip Stead, Aaron Stead, and a brand new author on the American scene, Mark Twain. Mythili Rao is a producer at the New Yorker Radio Hour at WNYC. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
It's great to have you with us on this Christmas version of The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, some actors wait a lifetime to land a role where they can really showcase their full talents. Most of them, let's be honest, never get that chance at all. For Leslie Odom Jr., that chance came at the relatively young age of 34, when he first helped to rock Broadway and America as Aaron Burr in Hamilton.
Theodosia writes me a letter every day. I'm keeping her bed warm while her husband is away. He's on the British side in Georgia. He's trying to keep the colonies in line. Well, he can keep all of Georgia. Theodosia, she's mine. Love doesn't discriminate.
Leslie Odom Jr. left the cast of Hamilton back in the summer of 2016. So now the question is, what's next?
I want to walk through all the doors that were not open before the phenomenon that I was so lucky to be a part of. And so film is one of those things. Those were not things that were easy to get. They're still not. And music is the other thing.
Right now, Leslie Odom Jr. is tackling film. He's on movie screens across the country in Murder on the Orient Express and also music. The deluxe edition of his album Simply Christmas is out now. I sat down with Leslie Odom Jr. to talk about the legacy of Hamilton and honestly, how you do another Christmas album.
I wanted it to be like a prime quality cut of meat, you know, a really well chosen cut of steak. I know there's vegans out there. NPR listeners, I know there's a lot of vegans. I'm talking to a lot of vegetarians right now.
They know what steak is.
But yeah, you know, really prime cut of tofu and something that didn't need steak sauce. You didn't need, you know, salt and pepper, just that it was just perfect. And so anything that didn't need to be there was stripped away. So some songs are just piano, and some songs, of course, we have the, you know, the big band feel. Every song on the record, for me, I know exactly why it's there, and felt like we managed to get to a version that felt authentic to who we were and felt necessary and classic at the same time.
Do you have a favorite on this album?
My favorite would probably be the first track and the last track. When you're making music these days, you can't assume that people are going to listen all the way down. You hope people listen all the way down, but just in case they don't, I mean, you kind of, those first three tracks are important. So the first track is my personal favorite, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It's the Christmas song that I've been singing the longest in my life.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
I think we managed to make a recording of it that feels, I hope, fresh and authentic to who we are, but, you know, also feels classic and timeless in a way, something that will sound good today. And if it makes its way into the traditions of your family, that's something that'll sound good 15 years from now, too, when you put it on. So that's my favorite. And then the last track, too, I do love the Ave Maria. That was the first time that I got to sing the Ave Maria.
Ave Maria.
It's done, I think, at Christmas time in the Catholic Church all the time, but we didn't. It wasn't something that was around when I was growing up, but it's just so, it's so beautiful.
Leslie, I read that you performed in a Baptist church when you were a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, we don't call it performing, but I did sing in a, I sang in a Baptist church all growing up. You know, I sang in the choir, and that's where I learned about singing in key and singing in harmony and pitch and all that stuff.
Did that help propel you to the stage? Did it really have anything to do with it? A lot of kids sing in church, of course, but maybe for you it was something more.
If it does relate to performing in any way, it kind of connects, because there's dancing in church. I didn't dance in church, but there, you know, there's dancers, especially these days, you know, I think they call them praise dancers and stuff in church. Mm-hmm. What it does is that it can connect art to ministry, which that jives with me, you know. Hamilton, for me, felt like ministry. My concerts today, I look at them like ministry, in that hopefully when I do my job right, the focus really isn't on you. The focus is the eternal and the inspiration and the magic in all of us, you know, that comes from somewhere else.
Hamilton was ministry for you. People love that show, ministry. Why?
Because I think that the truth is ministry. For me, you know, God is love, God is truth. And so whenever you're on stage talking about either one of those two things, it feels like ministry to me. That's what it feels like. It just connected to, like, the deepest parts of myself, you know, like DNA level, you know, what Lynn was able to talk about in this show that was about us and wasn't about us. You know, it's about these old dead white men, but it's still kind of about us right now. And what he was able to get to felt to me as honest and as rich as anything you'd find in your Bible.
I think for a lot of Americans, Hamilton was a form of secular ministry. It was a way for people to celebrate their history in a way that they connect to in the modern way, recasting it with a diversity that it was robbed from.
Yeah.
The first time around.
You know, Broadway is difficult because you're chained to the theater. I mean, you know, you're there every single night. But now, not being out of the show, I still get the benefits of singing in my concerts. I sing songs from the show and stuff from the albums, of course. But I'm connecting with people who didn't have access to the show in New York, and some, they don't have access sometimes to the show in LA. And what I'm finding out is that people's connection to it is very special to them, because it's something that people my age, I'm in my mid-30s, it's something that people my age share with their parents and their children. There's not many things in our society that we share across generational boundaries like that, or across cultural or religious boundaries. You know, there's not many things that unite us around a dinner table culturally. And Hamilton was that thing for people.
What does that show mean in the Trump era?
I think it means the same thing it meant before the Trump era. People are going to have to live with the choices that they make. When there's a movement that is speaking to the worst of who we are, when there's a movement that is designed to bring about derision and separation and ugliness, you know, that just brings about the worst of who we are, and you participate in that, maybe it's not now, but I think eventually you have to answer for that. You know, karma makes you answer for that. And you talk about the microphone. I do not say anything on my microphone that I would not say to the president of the United States' face. You know, I think sometimes that's the flaw of an artist, I think, or the people that have the microphones. It's like, you can say whatever you want, as long as that's something you would say to someone's face. If you had a face-to-face meeting, and you would you take that tone? I think what I'm trying to say is there seems to be a pull to the worst of who we are, to our basest instincts, and you have to fight that. You have to rise above that. We can talk about anything. We can have discourse, but we got to keep it respectful, even if the president of the United States won't.
Leslie Odom Jr., you know him as Aaron Burr from the hit musical Hamilton. He's got a re-release of his Christmas album, Simply Christmas. It's out now. Merry Christmas to you, Leslie Odom Jr. Thank you for being here.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for having me.
Bells will be ringing, the sad, sad news.
That's all for us today. And what a way to end our show on Christmas Day with the voice of Leslie Odom Jr., one of the stars of Hamilton, singing us his Christmas songs. From all of us here at The Takeaway, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Feliz Navidad. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Once again.
PRI, Public Radio International.